Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, July 13th. President Trump is doing so badly in the polls right now because of his virus denial and open hostility to the racial justice movement that he has actually reversed himself on one of those two things. He wore a mask in public over the weekend. Maybe you missed it. Maybe he did it on a Saturday so fewer people would see. But he wore a mask in public, reversed himself on that. Centering white grievance in his reelection campaign continues, however, along with portraying himself as the victim of the corruption he is allegedly committed. He commuted Roger Stone's sentence Friday night. I'm sure you heard that. Remember, Stone was convicted of lying to Congress to cover up for Trump regarding Russia. Now Trump has returned the favor and covered for Stone. Even Attorney General William Barr, have you heard this clip? Even Bill Barr, no fan of the Mueller investigation, right, disagrees with the president on this one.
He was prosecuted while I was attorney general. I think the prosecution was righteous. And I think the sentence that the judge ultimately gave was fair.
Barr on Roger Stone on ABC just last week. Mitt Romney just calls it corruption. With us now, Perry Bacon Jr., who writes about public opinion, race and identity, and the South, especially Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell is facing a re-election challenge. Perry's latest article is called How Biden is Winning an Identity Politics Election So Far. Perry, great to have you on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So for you who write about Kentucky and the South in addition to national politics, can you start with a take on how the spike in COVID cases across the South is affecting Trump's approval rating or election polling? These are the people he convinced not to wear masks or take the virus too seriously, and now look at their states.
You know, Brian, I'm not so, it looks like his national numbers have gone down in this last 2 month period. I think Biden was ahead around 6 points in early April. He's ahead around 10 points now. The two big things that have happened, of course, have been Trump's handling of COVID and how poorly that's gone, and also Trump's responses to the protests around George Floyd's death and how he seems out of touch with the electorate. But I'm not sure I would say that he's declining in the South because of those things. If you looked at it for a while now, the polls in Georgia, Texas, Florida, those states, maybe you could say in Georgia and Texas, Trump has made it closer. I think I would say that, in fact, Georgia and Texas are closer because of the way Trump is declining generally. I would say that states like Arizona and Florida were already swing states already and were places Biden could have won anyway.
Well, what about Texas and Georgia? That's really interesting that Biden is even polling as competitive, or I think slightly ahead of Trump. Am I seeing that right? In Texas and Georgia. So what does the data tell you about what that is about? How COVID-related, how racial justice-related, or anything else?
So our polling average has Biden slightly ahead in Georgia, and I believe is still basically tied in Texas. I mean, like, if I had to bet money on these races, I still think those are conservative states. Trump probably ends up winning them narrowly. But overall, what we're seeing is that basically what you're seeing is when the whole electorate has shifted this far away from Trump, where Trump is, you know, his approval rating is down, his disapproval rating is much higher. When he's down 10 points nationally, you know, Texas and Georgia are part of the United States. So on some level, that's what's happening, is simply that though that his numbers overall, like that those reflect his broader numbers overall. I would zone in specifically on what you've seen in 2016 and even before that was You know, Hillary Clinton did worse than Barack Obama in most states. Hillary Clinton did better than Barack Obama did in Texas and Georgia. And what that goes to is those two states are getting more diverse in terms of the percentage of people who are minorities in those states is going up. But also the second factor, and this is a big part of why Beto O'Rourke did so well in particular, is that the people in the urban areas, including the white ones, are moving left. And I think that has something to do with the way the Republican Party is handling itself on racial issues, where these sort of college educated urban people around Dallas, Atlanta, Houston, the white people are becoming more Democratic. And that, I think, is what's driving this shift and making these states very potentially Democratic this year.
Yeah. And so that's in your article about Biden winning identity politics or an identity politics election so far. As you put it, you start with the fact that Trump has always been unpopular with people of color, not just black voters, but he lost Latinx and Asian American voters overwhelmingly in 2016 too. But the change is that you're right, that the data so far suggests that Trump's language and behavior on racial issues is becoming less appealing to white voters with college degrees and even white voters without college degrees than it was in 2016. What are some specifics on that?
So the context of this piece was, we left the 2016 election, Trump won, he ran on this kind of white grievance, you know, platform, identity politics, you know, ban the Muslims, build the wall, et cetera. And I think a lot of people left that election thinking, hey, and Hillary Clinton, by the way, sort of defended Black Lives Matter. She said deplorables. So a lot of people, even liberals, sort of left the election saying, okay, if the election's about racial issues, then we're in trouble. You have to avoid that. And what the piece argues is that essentially maybe that's not correct. And maybe that's, we overread 2016 a little bit. I would argue the way Donald Trump is behaving, where he's defending the Confederate flag and things like that, and Confederate monuments, I think Trump feels like, hey, I just won election this way, and obviously that means this platform works. And I think I would argue, based on the evidence we have so far, that that strategy worked exactly once in November 2016. It didn't work in 2017 in Virginia. It didn't work in 2018 in the midterms, and it's not working now. And some of the key things that are worth keeping in mind is that, in general, public opinion moves against whoever is the sitting president. So there are certain things that Obama did that got more unpopular when he was there. So part of what we might be seeing is all these polls saying that sort of like Americans have more liberal views on racial issues, they support Black Lives Matter more. That may be true, but it may just also be that Trump is the president and Trump is an unpopular president. So if it seems like Trump is against Black Lives Matter, that may be pointing people to be for it. Like a lot of the polls on immigration, for example, people are more supportive of immigration and immigrants. That could be a change in the electorate's views, but it could be a change in, if most people oppose Donald Trump, and it sounds like Donald Trump opposes immigration, that may be a signal that they should be for it. And I think this is something worth thinking about. Go ahead.
But the question, just to follow up on that one for a second, there's a question of how much backlash there is. And it's funny the way, when you put it that way, it's like, oh, we're a country of contrarians. We're going to dislike whatever the sitting president does just because we like to dislike authority, or there's always backlash or whatever it is. But the last three presidents all got reelected, right? So Clinton did things that were unpopular and he got reelected. Same with Bush, same with Obama. Trump's reelection seems actually threatened by the degree of backlash. So something more or more intensely must be changing.
I would suggest that Trump started off being significantly more unpopular than those two people. Like he buried it. So one part in the piece itself, I agree with you, Brian, what you just said. I also would say Trump won a very fluky election in which he was fairly unpopular, won very, very narrow margin with a bunch of weird things that happened to help him win. So in some ways he started off. So in some ways the reading of 2016 that somehow Trump, I guess I've always thought that the reading of 2016 that Trump was some kind of brilliant politician from that was basically wrong. Mm-hmm. It was like brilliant to beat 15. It was to beat the Scott Walkers and the Jeb Bushes did require some actual skill. But the general election was kind of random. If he can plan for the FBI director to announce an investigation of his opponent every election at the 10 days before it happens, he'll be in good shape. But I'm guessing he's, I mean, maybe he'll do it again. I wouldn't rule it out. But I think that's going to be harder to do than before. Another point in the piece we wrote is two of the things I should mention is mm-hmm. three things I should mention is that one of them is that Biden may be harder to run against on an identity platform than Clinton and Obama were to some extent in 16. Like Biden is an older white man who has sort of moderate views on a lot of issues. And I do think, you know, voters do perceive people based a little bit on their identity, and it may help that Biden is an older white man. I do think the evidence suggests, I don't want to overdo the contrarian thing. I'm glad you pushed back on that. Mm-hmm. I do believe these polls, and I do think the country is changing on racial issues. Trump has changed it some. It was changing already. And I think the last month has changed its views even more. So I do think the country's views about Black Lives Matter, about racism, are changing in a direction that is not helpful to Trump. And the final point in the piece we made is that we have NASCAR, we have Facebook, we have the military. Basically every institution in America, all elite institutions, the press, I would argue, is making the case that racial inequality is a big problem the country should address. Donald Trump is in some ways speaking, it's not just an R&D fight, I would say. I would say it's many of the bigger cultural institutions in America are saying one thing. Joe Biden is saying that thing. Donald Trump is saying no, Confederate monuments should not be taken down. So he's in a place where he's fighting not just like the Washington Redskins are changing their name today. And if you live in Washington, you will know, or if you've been to Washington, that is a huge shift that goes to the fact that Trump is fighting against a broader cultural dynamic that is beyond just politics.
Yeah. And when you mention corporations in that respect, that Washington football team, whose outgoing name I will not say, why did they do it? The reason for succumbing to the pressure now, after resisting it for decades, that many people are citing is mostly that FedEx, which owns their stadium or the naming rights to their stadium, I'm not sure which, and Nike, which is a major sponsor, have threatened to withdraw their support. So could something similar be at play with respect to Trump's reelection campaign, or is that a stretch?
No, I think it's absolutely the case. I got emailed. We do a podcast at 538. And after the podcast, a pastor who lives in southeast Pennsylvania emailed me and he said, look, I'm a centrist person. My congregation is very pro-Trump. And most of the last 4 years, I've had to avoid discussing my concerns with Trump's conduct, how he sees himself. But he's like, when NASCAR sounds like I do, or when their Facebook posts sound like what I do, you know, taking a more liberal view on racial issues, it opens up the space, this pastor was saying, for me to discuss these issues more openly, to be more critical of like Trump's sort of views, if not Trump directly. So yes, I think this is a huge factor, is that it makes conversations different when it seems like, you know, like NASCAR is not defined as left. And so I think it makes a difference when NASCAR is banning the Confederate flag.
Alan in Brooklyn has a vice presidential candidate to nominate. Alan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
I had a few comments. First of all, I think we have an abundance of good people in the field of women on the list. But I'm wondering, first of all, why some people don't ever get on the list. I never hear Claire McCaskill mentioned, even though I think she's very qualified and probably a good vote getter. I think, above all, Warren is probably the best to be president if you have a man who's as old as Biden being elected, and you want to have somebody who, you could say, right day one, she could be sitting in the White House. But I also think that Duckworth is a very strong candidate for her life story and her being very articulate about the issues, and in addition to being able to talk about her role as a war hero. So any of those, I think, would be very strong.
Thanks.
I don't think we should be, yeah.
Go ahead. No, you want to finish the thought, you can.
I don't think we should be succumbing to the pressure from some elements of the party to try to have a second black president in one decade. I think that's an overreach, and I think that would lose. We should not allow Biden to look like he is succumbing to pressure from the left by having a black nominee for vice president right now, because that would say Biden is too weak to do what he knows is right for the country as a whole right now, and the country doesn't want to have a second black president in one decade. He would lose.
Wow. A lot of people would disagree with that and say that's too diminishing of the need for a racial justice gesture by Biden by putting a black woman on the ticket, and also might underplay the electoral math. So actually, Perry Bacon, since you do public opinion analysis, let me get you on that, because there are, you know, various schools of thought on which part of the potential Democratic electorate it is most strategic for Biden to try to maximize. And just in sheer strategy terms, never mind the long arc of history or, you know, racial justice and equity questions, just strategically, from your understanding of the numbers, is he likely to do more to maximize turnout, or he needs to maximize turnout by having a popular black woman on the ticket with him, as opposed to avoiding that, as the caller suggests, or having a popular white woman?
Okay, let me say the first thing, which no one believes but is actually true. The vice presidential pick has historically, and even in the polls now, has very, very, very little impact, period. So in some ways, like, these electoral claims that I hear every day from everyone are basically almost always overstated and wrong. You know, most people will vote for the top of the ticket. Almost everyone votes for the top of the ticket. The only exception to this is in 2008, when John McCain picked someone people viewed as unqualified, and that did hurt him some, but even a small amount. He was going to lose anyway.
Sure,
so I would start by saying that. But if you were looking at where Biden might be weaker than and stronger, I would say that it would be people under 45. And it's not in Democratic leaning people under 45. It's not that they're going to vote for Trump. It's that there's some evidence that they're not as excited. They're not as motivated by him. They're not as excited to give money to him. They're not as energized about him. So if you could find somebody who excites that younger part of the party, which opposed him in the primary, that would be the most strategically useful thing to do. You're going to ask me who does that, mm-hmm. and I don't know the answer to that question, in part because the under 45 vote went to Bernie Sanders, and he's not going to pick Bernie Sanders.
Right. And the caller assumes a certain amount of white racism that is so entrenched that there would be a backlash against a black woman on the ticket that could sink Biden. Do you have any data to support or refute that?
I mean, I'm old enough to remember a black president elected in two elections in a row. I'm being a little bit facetious, but no, there's not a, like, Harris, you know, there's a lot of polls of, the polls of Harris Biden, Warren Biden, and Klobuchar Biden that I had seen were all fairly similar. So I just don't see the evidence that there's this huge backlash if he picked. We should note, of course, Kamala Harris, Susan Rice, Val Demings, Stacey Abrams, and Keisha Bottoms are all different people. Yes. So I don't want to exaggerate the black woman effect, or even the, you know, I tried to write about this in my piece a few days ago and kind of push back on this, like, the idea that a black woman would inspire black people to vote for them, that seems intuitive, but Stacey Abrams ran for office in a state with a huge black population. Susan Rice has never run for office in any state anywhere. So the idea they would have sort of similar or equal effects with black voters seems to sort of not give black voters any agency in their thinking about politics.
Chauncey in Setauket on Long Island. You're on WNYC with Perry Bacon Jr. from 538. Hi, Chauncey.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me. Question here. In the 2016 election, people pointed to the idea of social desirability and then also voter suppression as to why there was a discrepancy in polling and then the actual vote. How big of an issue is that going to be in the 2020 election and with the polls?
So I don't see a lot of evidence from the polls that just to explain briefly, social desirability is the idea that people basically lie to pollsters. So the idea would basically be that there are some people who were like supported Trump, but thought that wasn't popular to say. So they told pollsters they were voting for Hillary, but then they voted for Trump. I don't think we have a lot of evidence for that from 2016. And so what I might say is the failure of the 2016 polling in some of these Midwest states was that people who are college, there was an undersampling of white Americans who don't have college degrees and oversampling of white Americans who do have college degrees. That was the problem. Trump did better with whites without degrees, and they were undersampled in the polls. So I think that has been adjusted for in some ways by the polls. 2018 had better polling results in the more accurate polling was done in 2018, but I'm not going to promise the polls will be perfect, particularly if the race is very close, then polls that are 1 to 2 points off end up being off in determining who wins. Now, the issue about voter suppression, I don't think in 2016 we have great evidence that voter suppression really had a big factor in the election. I do think in 2020 is a whole different thing to where, you know, how are the rules set up the election? What happens if there's a pandemic and there's a big corona outbreak in your poll in your state in October? Are Republicans trying to limit early voting or limit absentee voting in ways that make it harder for certain populations to vote? Particularly if there's a pandemic. I think these polls showing Biden ahead by a lot, we can't take into account for the fact that how hard it might be to vote, particularly for more distressed populations. And so I think that's an important factor, but one that I can't really account for because I don't know what the electoral environment and the health environment will be in October and November.
Chauncey, thank you. One more polling question. Jim in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for your guests regarding polling in its entirety. I've read a couple of pieces recently that essentially warned Democrats, I suppose, against taking polls at this point too seriously. One of them argued that way back in 88, the polls had Michael Dukakis well ahead of Bush 1, and of course we know what happened with that. And also back in 2016, about this time, Hillary was leading Trump rather substantially, and of course, you know, what happened in 2016. So how really relevant are polls at this point to what might likely happen in November? And I'm also worried that this kind of conversation about Biden being way ahead can really backfire on people who want to see Trump removed. And I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Thank you. And I will note that your article had the words "so far" in the title.
Yeah, I don't think polls are useless because they don't predict what's going to happen in October. Yes, I would agree with you that think about how much has changed in America from January 2020 to July 2020. Yeah. So assuming any kinds of changes that are big, I hopefully will not have a second mystery virus breakout, but I'm assuming that some changes will happen. So I think that's true. That said, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are reading these polls. So these polls are affecting their behavior. And so in that sense, understanding the state of the election right now helps you understand what's happening right now. If the polls are closer in September, I promise you the news media will cover the polls are closing and will reflect that. So, yes, do I think Joe Biden is going to win by 10 because polls show him ahead by 10 right now? I do not think that. I'm not sure about that. I would rather be Joe Biden than Donald Trump, according to the polls right now. And if you listen to Donald Trump, he agrees with me. He's been saying lately, talking about the idea that he might lose. He reads the polls, his staff reads the polls, and they're going to start adjusting their strategy, in my view. I think the mask, you know, Donald Trump wearing a mask on Saturday, I don't think is unrelated to Donald Trump being down by 10 in the polls.
Perry Bacon Jr. from 538. Thank you so much.
Brian, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.